Yes, please.
Yeah, so this is Burns. You talked about the axion strings, and what is roughly the scale of these things? Could they be like really large, larger than the horizon? And is this related to the like astrophysical searches for cosmic strings via gravitational lensing and so on?
Yes, great. So when people talk about cosmic strings, they're usually so-called gauge strings. That is to say, they are located basically on a line, because the U1 symmetry is gauged. And so all the energy is located on a line. Whereas the axion string is a global string, and most of the energy is actually surrounding the core of the string. Let's just clarify that point, okay? Maybe that was understood before. So often when people talk about cosmic strings, they're talking about gauge strings. I don't know that they're ever talking about global strings. So about the scales, which is an important issue, the scale of the core of the string is the Petchiquin scale, so maybe 10 to the 12 GeV. Whereas the scale, the infrared cutoff on this energy in the string is, as you are implying, an astrophysical scale, like the horizon, or the distance between strings, or the size of a loop. And it turns out, I didn't really have the time to explain this in detail, a lot to say, that the most important time for axion string radiation is just before QCD. That's when most of the, you know, that's when the biggest contribution is. So in that case, the horizon then is of order 10 to the minus 7 seconds. And there is, I think, the ratio between the two scales is e to the 100, e to the 100. The log of the ratio is 100. So there's a tremendous range. Okay, I drew this plateau of energy density and moment and wave vector stays, you know, this long, but it is, you know, enormous. I don't know. Is that answering the question?
Yeah, when you say the length of the core, that's kind of like the diameter of a string, the gauge of a string in the case of what you buy at the shop, or is it the actual length of the string?
It is, okay, the field goes like, actually the gradient of the field, because the energy density is the gradient of the field squared. That gradient goes like 1 upon r. So it would blow up, you see, at r equals to 0. But that's regularized by the fact that if you go to such high energies, then the energy is restored. So actually, the core size is the Petchiquin scale. Am I making this clear? So you have a string. Its core size is given by the Petchiquin scale, and then it has a field surrounding that.
Yeah, and I'm asking about the longer direction.
Oh, how long it is?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it is not straight, right? I drew it straight, though, because it's easy. But of course, the string is not usually straight. So thank you for this question, for clarification. In the early universe, these strings appear as topological defects. Because when the Petchiquin phase transition occurs, different horizons will adopt different values of this theta angle. And sometimes you'll have a defect. Actually, Kibble first emphasized the fact that you would produce these topological defects in phase transitions in the early universe. So the string then, if it relaxes a little bit, is some random walk in physical space. And it may close upon itself, but it may not. Actually, I appreciate your question more. So it will tend to relax, right, by emitting axion radiation. But it will also cut other strings. And when it cuts other strings, there's an opportunity, a probability to reconnect. So if you have these long strings that go beyond the horizon, they will cut each other into loops that will then radiate away. That's the picture.
Okay, thank you.
May I ask a question? So it can end on what kind of objects, the string you are talking about? It can end on what kind of objects?
In the case of axion strings, it doesn't actually end. It does not end. It goes on forever.
Or it closes on itself.
Itself. There's no... you could make a model where indeed you have some objects, some maybe, I don't know what it is, but some topological soliton at the end.
Yeah.
But that's not inside of the Pitcher-Quinn symmetry. That's not a consequence of Pitcher-Quinn symmetry.
Okay.
Yes, please.
My name is Basti Sharma from Nikkev, Amsterdam. I have two questions. So first, what are expectations for finding axions at the LHC in round three or maybe even the high luminosity?
To produce axions at the LHC, they have to be relatively strongly coupled. And in the simplest models, this seems very unlikely, at least to me. So, there are these constraints on the couplings of the axion that go all the way up, axion decay constant all the way up to say from particle physics experiments, nuclear physics experiments, but also stellar evolution, that go all the way up to the decay constants of order 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 GeV. So in the simplest models, these axions are very weakly coupled and would only have very small production cross sections. And you have to realize that if you want to look at them at the LHC, you have to produce them and detect them. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to discourage anyone from doing an experiment. You should not necessarily trust theorists to give you good guidance. But if you ask me, I would say that to have an axion that is visible at the LHC, you would have to construct a model that escapes all these previous bounds, and it would have to be very special. I remember there was a situation where people found some peak in E plus E minus spectrum, and people got very excited. The peak was at 1.8 MeV. I forgot. This peak has now gone away. People got sufficiently excited to construct axion models that escaped previous bounds, you see. But, okay.
Right.
I think I've answered.
Mm-hmm. So the second one, should it be also something like a cosmic axion wave background, just like we have a cosmic microwave background and people talk about a cosmic neutrino wave background?
Yes, of course. So there is in fact cosmic axion backgrounds. In fact, there is basically a double background in the sense that there are thermal axions whose typical temperature today is of order 1 degree Kelvin, like photons and neutrinos. Mm-hmm. But there is, in addition, a cold axion background whose temperature today is extremely small, like 10 to the minus 34 degree Kelvin. Those are the cold axions. The candidates, that population is the candidate for cold dark matter. Okay. Thermal axions, like neutrinos, move too fast to be gathering in galactic halos, so they're not a good cold dark matter candidate. Yes, so there is a That's cosmic axioms, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, yes, Aidan Chatwin-Davies. I'd like to ask another question about these axion strings, and namely, does the topology of the universe affect them? So, for example, whether the universe is spatially compact versus spatially non-compact?
Yes, I think that is a very interesting question, which unfortunately I have not given much thought. You have, I guess you can have universes that are not simply that wind around themselves in some way. And if it the topology has a non-trivial pi 1, I guess, that is to say the space of closed loops in this universe is non-trivial, you could have strings that go this way and they would be topologically stable. That's right, I guess. If they go to their lowest energy configuration, there would be some string going through here and it winds around on some very large distance. I think that's an interesting concept. I don't think there's much literature about that, but maybe that should be considered.
Thanks.
Yes, please.
Any more questions?
So these domain walls, do they have any interesting physics similar to like the bubbles in electroweak baryogenesis, or are they actually stable, these domain walls? Or?
Yes, I actually talk a little bit more about them tomorrow. Here's a puzzle. Witten showed that if you have a magnetic monopole and you change the theta parameter, then the monopole becomes electrically charged, it becomes a dipole. So if you take the monopole and you move it through a domain wall, in the domain wall, the axion field goes around once the Mexican hat potential at the bottom. So theta changes there by 2 pi. So actually the monopole acquires a charge. So you may wonder how it's possible for this monopole to acquire a charge when it goes through the domain wall. So I think this is an interesting question, which actually has an answer. There's a lot of interesting things about the domain walls. They're a little bit more complicated than to say that the axion field simply goes around the bottom of the Mexican hat potential. Because when it does that, the axion is actually mixed with the pi zero, the neutral pion. And if you look at the domain wall more carefully, there's actually a double, there's an axion wall and there's a pi naught wall. Okay. Then you can look at issues, how do particles interact with the wall? You know, do they get reflected? And you can show, for example, that if you have a photon going through the wall, its plane of polarization will rotate some. So there are a lot of interesting things, yes. Whether they have been used to explain anything, I don't know. Yes, please.
So if I understood correctly, the axion string the strings could radiate axions.
Yes.
So now, if you take, for instance, a domain wall, can we also then get the similar situation?
Yes. Thank you for this question. Okay. So when the string is radiating, is before the QCD phase transition, and the axion is massless. So there's no energetic barrier towards radiating axions. The domain wall forms after the QCD phase transition when the axion has acquired a mass. And so to produce axions from the domain wall by itself, it would have to be flapping at a frequency on a scale larger than the QCD scale. And actually, that's not going to happen after QCD because it will get homogenized. However, there is a process by which the domain wall does radiate a lot of axions, because the domain wall can be cut by a string, you see. Then what happens is that the string will unwrap the domain wall, and that will produce a lot of axions. And they will tend to be more energetic. They will tend to be, this is why the domain wall contribution is actually not so important, we believe, because this process produces energetic axions. So when you use energy conservation, because the axions are more energetic, there's fewer of them, and because later the axions become non-relativistic, it is actually the number that matters. The number goes down, and the energy density goes down today. Thank you. All questions are brilliant.
Thank you.
All answers are suspect, you know.
Any more questions?
Yes.
Antonio Masiero.
Antonio.
The past, we had the proposal for other solutions to the theta problem. Instead of using the Peccei-Quinn symmetry, for instance, having one massless quark, maybe the up quark. Or also an interesting idea related to your slide where you have shown that the theta parameter depends on the argument of a determinant of a quark mass matrix. So the attempt of enforcing, say, real quark mass matrix. So these attempts, in fact, had a lot of work on
yes,
them.
Yes, yes.
So what is this, the situation concerning alternatives to the Peccei-Quinn proposal?
Okay, Antonio, thank you for bringing that up. Okay, first, there is the possibility that the M quark mass is zero. And of course, this was quickly recognized to be a possibility. Today, if you ask people who do QCD simulations, they say this is not possible. I am not the right person to discuss this. But there is something that it is worth pointing out, even aside from the lattice simulations. I think the lattice simulations are actually the more important guide. The CP violating effects are proportional in the limit of very small up quark masses, proportional to theta bar times the up quark mass.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So if you want them to be less than some small number, like to accommodate the absence of a neutron electric dipole moment, you have to have a very small up quark mass. It's not just zero is fine, it has to be very small. But there is nothing actually protecting in that case. There's no chiral symmetry that sets M up equals to zero in this situation. If you take the M quark mass equals to zero, you know, the chiral symmetry where you rotate this by a phase is anomalous. And so it is actually not particularly natural. This is my theory comment, okay? But I think it's very simple. I mean, you know, that's very good. Okay, one should consider these possibilities. Then you bring up the other possibility is that you have spontaneous CP violation.
Yes.
So this is a scheme. There's lots of papers about it. I forget actually who first proposed it. May have been Becky Begg, actually. And I know
yes.
Mohapatra has written about it, and actually many others. And there's a set of models by Nelson and Barr that are very popular.
Yes, a concrete model was okay. Barnett's
song. Yeah, the tenor of these models is that you have no CP violation, you have a model that is CP conserving at the level of the Lagrangian. So then it's natural to set theta bar equals to zero because you have a symmetry protecting it, and then you have spontaneous CP violation. And then when you have spontaneous CP violation, you induce the value of theta bar. But what these orders show is that, you know, there's a general class of models where you can arrange the model in such a way that the calculated value of theta bar is small. You know, there's some, it depends upon some parameters, and, you know, theta bar is small when you calculate. So no, it's finite and small. So I think that's a perfectly acceptable solution. I don't have anything bad to say about it, except it doesn't have axions and all the fun you have with axions.
Maybe it is a bit difficult to keep the stability of this solution. I don't know, because you have to enforce it up to the, I don't know, two or three loop level, right, to keep the theta small enough. So
you mean in the sense of perturbation theory?
Yes.
Okay, you may well be right about that. Yes, yeah. Because you calculate in lowest order, but then you should calculate in higher orders and see what happens. Yeah, I think that's a good point, yes. Right. Also, another aspect of this is that you do have domain walls in that case, because when you spontaneously break CP, you have two vacua, actually, that are CP mirror, you know, CP mirror images. So maybe universe will go sometimes in this vacuum, sometimes in the other, so you have domain walls in between. So I think it does require that you have inflation after this phase transition, so that these domain walls get blown out of the picture.
Sophie Motzel, hi. So you talked about axions as dark matter candidates. Are there also models where the axion is the inflaton?
Sorry, I didn't quite hear.
You talked about the axion being a dark matter candidate.
Yes.
Are there also models where the axion can be the inflaton?
Yes. There are many interesting scenarios where axions, I don't know, play another role. So in particular, in so-called natural inflation models, I think that's what you have in mind, right? The inflaton is like an axion. It's not actually the QCD axion though, right? As far as I know. But the idea, this inflaton has very similar properties to the axion, yeah. So the axion has a bunch of interesting properties that I haven't even touched upon.
But so the possibility of the axion being the inflaton and solving the strong CP problem is ruled out, or?
I don't know. There is a scenario where the inflaton is the QCD axion, where you have a single scalar field that solves both problems. But that may just be ignorance on my part.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so it's Berns. In PJ Quinn, you assume you have to introduce quite a few ingredients, not just the U1 asymmetry, but several other fields, and those two different theories, like this four alphabetic numbers that alphabet names that predict different numbers for the couplings. For example, they have like different exotic quarks, like triplet quarks or something, right? I never fully understood these aspects. Is there an easy
yes.
way to understand it? And also, what are the side effects of Pitcher-Quinn assumptions that one could possibly measure?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. A lot can be said about that. So There's an original Pacheco-Quinn PQWW model in which it is actually the standard model with two Higgs fields. And there's the scale of Pacheco-Quinn breaking is the electroweak scale. I didn't emphasize this, I probably should have. There was then a revolution where the scale of Pacheco-Quinn breaking was shown that it could be very large. That produced the so-called invisible axion, and the orders are KSVZ and DFSZ. Okay. Kim, Schiffman, Weinstein, Zakharov, Dine, Fischler, Shrednicki, Zignitsky. Okay. So how do you do that? In the original version by Kim, you introduce a heavy quark. And the quark is very heavy. It's of actually, it can be, generally, it's of order the Pacheco-Quinn breaking scale. And it's so heavy, you don't see it in any of today's experiments. Nonetheless, even though it's very heavy, this is a property of the anomaly. The fact that it exists shows up in the coupling of the axion to GG dual. The axion does enter, like in the Pacheco-Quinn model. And so, so that's one version. And of course, there's many possibilities. The Dine, Fischler, Shrednicki, Zignitsky model actually used the standard model, which actually, used the PQWW model, which has two Higgs fields, but introduced another Higgs field that has Pacheco-Quinn charge, and it has a very large expectation value. Then also the axion is invisible. So in that case, you have two Higgs fields. And now I'm not an expert on have all the limits of LHC, but many of you are, and maybe I should ask, is that still allowed to have two Higgses? I was at Saclay a few days ago, and they said this actually is now pretty unlikely. So this is interesting, I think. The DFSZ model has a nice property that you can grant unify it, and it gives a definite relation, a definite value for the axion coupling to two photons. However, it's not necessary to do DFSZ to have a grand unified axion model. You couldn't just do like Kim, have a grand unified theory, similar to Kim, I should say, grand unified theory like SU5, have one heavy SU5 multiplet that plays the same role as Kim's heavy quark. And then you'll also have the DFSZ coupling. Sorry, my answer is a little long-winded, but there's actually a lot to say about that. Maybe I've answered.
No? Hi, Fogel. I was wondering if you could comment about, I don't know if this is still a thing that exists, but once I've read something about the axion quality problem related to gravity being something that people think that gravity would break any global symmetry. Could you comment on that? I've never understood exactly. Please.
Yes, that's interesting. Thank you. I thought somehow someone was going to ask this. So there is a general belief that if you have a global symmetry, that it will be broken by quantum, by gravity. And the sort of mechanism is that global charge gets eaten up by a black hole and the black hole radiates away. Or somehow the global charge will disappear. If you say that the violation of Pacheco-Quinn symmetry by gravity is suppressed by a power law, is a higher order operator, you know, with some finite power, then you'll tend to think that there is a quality problem. But it's never been clear to me that that's actually what quantum gravity does. There's actually a very nice paper by Susskind, Linde, Galosh, and I think someone else, who show that, they do some, some calculation in quantum gravity that show that the suppression is exponential and that there is, in fact, no such problem. I just know of the paper, okay. I haven't really checked it, but I like it, so quoted. I've always thought it's a little strange to have to compare something that's motivated by experiment, like the strong CP problem, against something that may be a property of quantum gravity that we don't actually know what it is. So I don't tend to worry about this because it's not stuff that I can feel I can balance. You know, I go by stuff that answers questions in the real world that we don't understand perfectly, but okay, we understand somewhat.
Thanks.
All right. So you give tomorrow another lecture, so
yes,
there may be still questions, you know, hanging here in the room, but they can come tomorrow. So, okay.
Thank you.
So thank you very much.
Thank you for the questions. The questions are actually more interesting.